Hello, this is Wendy Bauer returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, May 30th, 2016. We continue now with the death notices. Pauline Coleman, Decatur. Pauline Coleman, 80, of Decatur, died Tuesday, May 24th, 2016. Services celebrating her life will be held at 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 31st, 2016, with visitation from 11 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. at Salem Baptist Church, 2650 South Taylorville Road. Burial will be in Camp Butler National Cemetery. Elizabeth Dunn, Decatur. Elizabeth Dunn, 77, of Decatur, died May 11th, 2016. Memorial services will be at 4 p.m. on Tuesday in Freedom Assembly of God Church. Burial will be at a later date. Funerals pending for today, Monday, May 30th, 2016. Kathleen Carpenter, 87, of Decatur, who died Sunday, May 29th, 2016. Moran and Goebel Funeral Homes handling the arrangements. William A. Cooper, 66, of Decatur, died Saturday, May 28, 2016. Brindlinger and Earl Funeral Homes of Decatur handling the arrangements. And a funeral scheduled for today, P.J. Searlock, 93, of Moequa. Funeral at 1:30 p.m. in Westside Cemetery, Moequa. And now from local news. This is an article actually from Friday. Allison Petty writes from Decatur, judge to decide fate of Sweeney lawsuit. The future of former Decatur Police Chief Brad Sweeney's lawsuit against the city of Decatur now rests with a Macon County judge. Macon County Circuit Judge A.G. Weber IV heard more than an hour of arguments Thursday concerning the legal basis for the case before saying he would take them under advisement. I do want a chance to take a look at what's been pleaded, compare it with case law, and give you a written decision in the reasonably near future, Weber said. Sweeney alleges that he was fired by City Manager Tim Gleason on February 4th in retaliation for several events, refusing to publicly support a local motor fuel tax, opposing the tax during the city staff meeting, and objecting to Gleason's use of a police car and driver for a personal trip in May 2015. The city has argued that Gleason had multiple reasons to fire Sweeney, none of which related to the gas tax or police car ride. The hearing Thursday was not meant to determine what actually happened between Sweeney and Gleason. The judge must decide whether, assuming Sweeney's allegations are all true, the former chief has legal standing to pursue his case. Most of the arguments concerned the incident in which Gleason used a police vehicle and driver to make it to the St. Louis airport in time for a trip related to his son's Army service. Gleason had rearranged his travel plans to attend the Greater Decatur Chamber of Commerce State of the City breakfast. Sweeney has said he objected to the use of the police vehicle and driver at the time, and later reiterated to Gleason that it was improper and would not happen again. One part of his lawsuit alleges that he was fired in retaliation for reporting the act to Gleason, a violation of the Illinois Whistleblower Act. The city's attorneys, Ed Flynn and Jerry Stocks, argued that Sweeney could not claim protection when he participated in or allowed the behavior to which he says he objected. Further, they said, a person cannot be a whistleblower when reporting the violation of law to the violator and no one else. He's attempting to use those legal provisions that are meant to shield or protect an employee, and he's attempting to use them as a sword, Flynn said. Sweeney's attorney, John D. Robinson, said his client did everything he could to prevent Gleason's taking the car, which he described as illegal and improper. I don't know what more Brad Sweeney could have done at the time, given the fact that Mr. Gleason's attitude, as we know it now, he thought he could do whatever he wanted, and presumably he thought he was above the law, even the Illinois criminal statutes, Robinson said, referring to Gleason's testimony in a deposition. Weber asked Robinson several direct questions about Sweeney's actions regarding the police car, such as whether Sweeney could have refused to participate or to allow his officers to participate if he believed the order unlawful. He also asked whether Sweeney consulted anyone else, such as the mayor or the city's attorney, about the car ride after he was asked to provide it, 3 days before the trip took place. Robinson said it is now clear that it would not have done Sweeney any good to contact the Decatur City Council, as members have failed to get involved in the matter since his firing. He said this also raised questions about whether Decatur City Code complies with state law and whether, as a result, Sweeney was effectively terminated. He cited a section of Illinois Municipal Code that says the firing of a police or fire chief must be authorized by a city's corporate authority, which would be the council. Are you saying today that maybe your client is still the chief of police? Weber asked. He may be. As a matter of law, he may be, Robinson said. That's a question of interpreting the statute, I suppose. Flynn said that argument lacked any merit whatsoever. Illinois Municipal Code contains provisions governing multiple types of city government. Decatur is a home rule city, which means some parts of that law are not applicable, Flynn argued. Near the end of his argument, Robinson drew attention to roughly 8 uniformed members of Decatur Police Department Administration who sat in the courtroom along with other city staff members. I believe as a citizen and a taxpayer that is another abuse of power, an abuse of property and personnel, Robinson said. These people are not being paid to attend this hearing. They're not being paid by me or other taxpayers to attend this hearing so that they can support Mr. Gleason, the city manager. Interim Chief Jim Goetz said later that the administrators were not ordered by anyone to attend the hearing. They chose to do so in part so they could answer questions from the officers who work under them. These lieutenants and above have to know what's going on, what's going with the police department. They've got to know, is Chief Sweeney coming back or not coming back, said Goetz, who attended the hearing despite being on vacation. They need to know this. That's part of them being administrators. In a separate case, former Decatur Police Chief Mark Barthelme has asked for a special prosecutor to investigate Gleason's actions relating to the car ride, arguing that Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott has a conflict of interest that prevents him from doing so. Scott said Thursday that he plans to file a response in that case. A hearing is scheduled for June 20th. And a feature article by Teresa Churchill, Herald and Review senior writer. Home at last. Killed in action 48 years ago, Decatur soldier to be laid to rest. From Decatur. You hardly ever saw Alan Boyer without Doug Hagen, each new to MacArthur High School their junior year. That's how Steve Pyle, another member of the class of 1964, remembers the two friends, even though they were about as different as they could be. Doug was liberal, Al was conservative, and if you were on the student council, it was a big deal, said Pyle, 69, a photographer who moved from Decatur to Bowling Green, Kentucky 5 years ago. Our senior year, Doug was president and Alan was vice president. Each promising young life ended tragically in the Vietnam War. Boyer vanishing March 28, 1968, and Hagen killed August 7, 1971, while serving in the same Special Army Operations Unit Boyer had been in. Hagen wanted to find out what happened to his best friend, but he never did. Indeed, the first indication Boyer was dead did not come until 1973, when his name did not appear on a list of 591 American prisoners coming home after the war was over. They found no blood, no bodies, and no personal effects, so I thought, okay, he's been taken prisoner. His sister, Judy Boyer's Bouchard, said in a telephone interview from her home in Licklaw Ridge, North Carolina, "For 5 years, I held on to that hope." The mystery shaped a whole lot of her life, starting at age 19 when her big brother disappeared, and continuing until March 7th of this year, a couple weeks after she turned 67 and on the eve of what would have been her brother's 70th birthday. The U.S. Army telephoned to say his remains had finally been identified. "It absolutely knocked the wind out of me," Bouchard said. "The news is bittersweet, and I wish our parents had lived to see it." Charles Boyer, who worked at Borg Warner when the family lived in Decatur, died in 1994, and Dorothy Boyer, who taught at Brush College School, died in 2013. The Boyers, originally from suburban Chicago, settled in Rockford after their son graduated from high school in Decatur. And it was October 1967, during Bouchard's first semester at the University of Montana in Missoula, that she last saw her brother. It's not surprising she chose the same university he was attending when he decided to enlist in the Army to save the world from communism. "Alan was the quintessential big brother that I absolutely adored," she said. "He was the one who taught me how to ride a bike when I was about 4, never believing in training wheels. He also taught me how to drive when I was 16. Sergeant Alan Boyer and 2 other soldiers were conducting a reconnaissance patrol in Laos on March 28, 1968, when they encountered an enemy force and radioed for evacuation. The 7 Vietnamese with them escaped safely, but heavy fire forced the helicopter to leave without the 3 Americans, first listed as missing and later as presumed dead. Boyer's body, in possession of remains traders in Laos, recently ended up with a peace activist who turned it over to the U.S. government. The Army confirmed his identity by comparing the DNA samples given many years earlier by his mother and sister. "I was told it's the strongest DNA match they've ever seen," Bouchard said. "There's no doubt it's Alan." The Army awarded Boyer the Silver Star and Purple Heart posthumously. Today, Bouchard is preparing to lay her brother to rest on June 22nd in Virginia's Arlington National Cemetery, where Hagen is buried, and with full military honors. "He's probably up there shaking his head," she said, "but this is what our mom and dad wanted, if and when they ever found him. It's going to be a wonderful tribute." But Bouchard hasn't forgotten all the other people she met over the years who continue to wonder what happened to their loved ones. "Please remember all the POW MIAs who return unaccounted for," she wrote, to conclude a letter of thanks to friends after her brother was found. "Their families still wait." And a feature article by Huey Freeman, Herald and Review staff writer, "Young Sluggers Advance in Major League Home Run Derby." The article starts with a photograph of a young man. Austin Kitchen of Decatur hits the ball out of the park during a Major League Baseball home run derby at Borg Warner Sports Complex. From Decatur, "After T-ball coach Steve Strode saw an announcement while watching a Cardinals game on TV about an upcoming home run derby competition to be held nationwide, he decided to make sure young people in Decatur area had an opportunity to participate. He obtained permission to use the Borg Warner Sports Complex in South Shores and sent out a call for baseball and softball players 14 years and younger to come out on Saturday. My main platform was Facebook," said Strode, who was at the ball field along with his 6-year-old son, Kaysen, during the competition. "I had a little more than a week to plan it." Strode, an employee of Exelon Corporation, rounded up some volunteers among fellow workers at the Clinton Power Station to help the youngsters during the contest. He received a packet of basic guidelines from Major League Baseball, which told him what was expected from players in order to advance to the regional competition, to be held in Chicago on Sunday, June 5th. Winners at the regional level will be flown to San Diego, California to compete on the Padres field, Petco Park, during baseball's All-Star Week. Travel expenses are to be paid by Major League Baseball. The odds were good for advancement at the Decatur contest, with 6 boys and no girls showing up on Saturday. In order to qualify, each hitter had to hit only 1 home run. The home run distances were set at 200 feet for the older category, 13 and 14-year-olds, and 180 feet for the 12 and younger group. There was a wind mostly right to left for the hitters, but also blowing slightly toward the plate. Each contestant was allowed 10 outs, by contact only. Each was asked to decide, with the help of his parents, whether he wanted a pitcher of his choice to pitch to him, or to use an available pitching machine. Lucas Kuhlman, 12, of Elkhart, dazzled volunteers and spectators by hitting 16 home runs out of 20 batted balls, including some that went quite a distance past the home run line. Lucas, a player on the Mount Pulaski grade school team, was the overall winner. The other participants who qualified were Austin Schultz, 12, of Decatur, Austin Kitchens, 14, of Mount Zion, and Blake Followell, 13, of Clinton. Strode said he believed that many of the young ballplayers who did not appear were busy playing in tournaments. Next year, he plans to hold the competition during the week in order to provide opportunities for more hitters. And from Decatur, Huey Freeman, Herald and Review staff writer, writes, Marines medals catch up to him. Bob Pettinger didn't concern himself about medals when he was told by an officer that he could leave the Marine Corps early after returning from Vietnam. He was just happy to be able to return home after more than 13 months in country. 403 days in a war zone, to be exact. But when he realized more than 4 decades later that other members of his platoon received commendations he never heard of, he decided to try to obtain the honors he had earned. As a young man, Pettinger received honors for participating in less dangerous endeavors. He was a star athlete on the Lakeview High School Spartans, playing 3 sports all 4 years, including the role of right halfback on the undefeated 1965 football team. His .578 batting average in his final baseball season was the highest ever recorded at his school. A speedy shortstop and pitcher with a no-hitter to his credit, Pettinger had offers to play for college baseball teams. Major league clubs such as the San Francisco Giants and Pittsburgh Pirates also expressed an interest. But despite the efforts of his parents and baseball coach to convince him to develop his athletic talent, Pettinger was focused on putting on a different kind of uniform. I wanted to go to the Marine Corps, said Pettinger during an interview at his home near Lake Decatur, where he resides with Kay, his wife of 42 years. At the time of his high school graduation in 1967, he had 1 older brother in the Marines who had recently served in Vietnam, while his oldest brother was already a Marine veteran. I kind of looked up to them, Pettinger said, adding that he otherwise did not know why he wanted to join the Marines during the height of the Vietnam War. He was aware that his uncle Andy Screel had served valiantly in World War II, earning a Silver Star for actions with the Army's 95th Infantry Division, during which he received a battlefield promotion to lieutenant. Pettinger signed up the day after graduation and began basic training in October at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. He said the physical part was not tough for him because he was in top-notch shape. It is pretty good brainwashing, he said. They strip you of everything you've got, but they fill you with good things. You love your fellow Marines and you would die for them. After basic, he was assigned to an engineering battalion. The next day I got orders for Vietnam, Pettinger said. The first sergeant told him he would be in Vietnam for a year, so he would advance him some leave to see his family. He showed up at his family home, 3606 East Hardy Street, at 3 a.m., surprising his parents. His father was not immediately happy to see him because he thought he had gone AWOL. Pittenger's MOS, his job title, was combat engineer, despite the fact that he had just one day training in that field. When he arrived in Vietnam in May 1968 on a plane with about 150 other Marines, the first thing he noticed was the extreme heat. You could feel it going into your lungs, he recalled. When he arrived at the Dong Ha Combat Base, just south of the demilitarized zone, there was a memorial service for Marines who had recently been killed. There were boots on the ground and pots, helmets, Pittenger said. There was enough to make you think about it. Mostly you don't think about it, you just do what you're told to do. I was lucky. I got in with a bunch of guys who took me under their wing. Guys who were leaving left me stuff. They explained where to go when incoming came in and how to avoid getting hit. There was a member of his platoon named Mike who had been killed in action a couple of weeks earlier. Because of the timing, Pittenger was selected to replace him in a fuel unit. A guy picked me up at the airport at the bulk fuel office, Pittenger said. I didn't know jack about fuel. I wasn't trained. Pittenger spent much of his service time in Vietnam at Dong Ha. As soon as the C-130 transport landed when he first arrived, incoming artillery rounds hit the base. The 19-year-old Marine would learn to get used to enemy harassment, which was unnerving, but did not often produce casualties on that base. He worked security on the perimeter of the base, as well as guarding fuel convoys and loading docks on the nearby Qua Viet River. Pittenger was also stationed at a much smaller base, Landing Zone Stud, near Khe Zan, a former Marine combat base which had recently been involved in a major battle. Landing Zone Stud, also known as Hill 861B, was only about as big as 6 to 10 city blocks. Everyone lived underground. Because of the vulnerability from enemy shelling, shipping containers buried about 20 feet beneath the surface were transformed into living quarters. Six Marines shared Pittenger's 10-by-12-foot room, in which they slept on cots. You were nose to nose and toes to toes, Pittenger said. They would work topside 12 hours on, 12 hours off. There was a fan and a vent in the ceiling to keep them from suffocating. The landing zone was more dangerous. It's smaller, more isolated, Pittenger said. Choppers were coming in all the time, in and out, in and out. That draws fire. At Stud, there were more attacks from rockets and mortars. When he was at Dong Ha, which took fire from 155mm and 175mm artillery shells, there weren't enough underground bunkers for everyone. A captain, who did not like the idea of his Marines being afraid to live above ground, ordered everyone in the compound to live on the surface. A few weeks after that order was given, in May of 1969, Pittenger was asleep in his sandbagged hut. He thought he was dreaming when everything turned bright orange and he felt intense heat. A round hit the roof of the hut next door. Pittenger felt the impact of the explosion. It knocked me in the air, he said. Then I tried to get away. I got caught in my mosquito net. I eventually made it to the bunker. One Marine lost a hand, another lost a buttock. The captain was also wounded. While transporting fuel tankers, Pittenger sometimes rode shotgun in the vehicle, while other times he rode in accompanying jeeps or trucks armed with 50-caliber machine guns. Tankers made inviting targets for the enemy, but fortunately, Pittenger's squad did not suffer any losses. When Pittenger had served his stint in Vietnam, he received the welcome news in an El Toro Marine Corps air station in California that he was free to return home because he had fewer than 180 days left to complete his 2-year hitch. An officer explained at a formation that they were out of medals and ribbons. Pittenger, who was mustered out of the Corps in June 1969 with the rank of Lance Corporal, didn't think about recognition as he returned to civil life. He just wanted to forget about the war, Vietnam, and everything about it. He doesn't even remember what he did with his uniform. He went on to have a successful career in law enforcement, retiring from the Decatur Police Department in 1990 as a detective sergeant after 20 years of service. Then he hired on as a federal investigator with the U.S. Attorney's Office, where he served until 2005. I loved being a police officer, Pittenger said. I made a good living for my family. Like the service, I made a lot of good friends. After spending most of his life trying to forget about it, a Marine he knew in Vietnam contacted Pittenger, which led him to a company reunion in Virginia in 2012. Guys were talking about medals, he said. I never got anything. The Marine Corps made little effort to track me down and give them to me. My entire time in Vietnam, I was in a combat zone, my entire platoon. Beginning in 2012, Pittenger spent 2 years writing letters to try to obtain commendations that members of his 3rd Platoon, Bravo Company, 4th Logistics Command, 3rd Marine Division had received. After he received a packet of his military records listing his 17 combat operations, he was able to secure medals and ribbons originally issued by the U.S. and South Vietnam Armed Forces, including a Navy Unit Commendation Ribbon with Bronze Star, Combat Action Ribbon, and a Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. He constructed a handsome shadow box in which to display them. I think it's cool that after 47 years, it all caught up to me, Pittenger said. And finally, an article out of Bloomington by Lenore Sabota, Lee News Service writer. A Rosy Woman Set for Honor Flight. This Memorial Day, like most others, 91-year-old Gladys Barnes, a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars Auxiliary, expects to go to the annual parade in Bloomington. But she also will be doing something else, preparing to go on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. next month. Barnes is not a military veteran, but as a Rosie the Riveter, who repaired damaged bombers for about 2 years during World War II, she is eligible for the honor flight to see memorials in the nation's capital. She will be among 72 veterans and others taking part in the honor flight on June 7th, according to Michelle Sherman, a volunteer with Greater Peoria Honor Flight. 4 are from the Bloomington Normal area, she said. We take veterans to see the memorials to their fallen brothers and sisters in arms, said Sherman. On this flight, 12 participants are from World War II, 55 are Korean War veterans, and 5 are Vietnam veterans, she said. I'm really anxious to see the women's memorial in the Vietnam Wall, said Barnes, whose son is a Vietnam veteran. Her brother is a Pearl Harbor survivor. A cousin died when his plane went down in a storm in World War II. We lost a lot of good guys, she said. The Rosie the Riveter image was part of a government campaign to recruit women for jobs in the defense industry. A poster that was part of the campaign referred to them as soldiers without guns. A cover of the May 29, 1943 Saturday Evening Post had an illustration by Norman Rockwell of Rosie on a lunch break, Riveter on her lap, a flag waving in the background, her foot resting on a copy of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Another famous image from the war showed a woman with a bandana on her head, rolled up her sleeve, and the words, "We can do it." Barnes took her own "We can do it" attitude to Hill Air Force Base in northern Utah to repair damaged engines from planes, mostly B-17s and B-24 bombers. A Rosie the Riveter doll that was given to her sits atop a china cabinet in her dining room. She also has a Rosie the Riveter lunchbox. Todd Abling, a former commander of John Krause VFW Post 454 in Bloomington, nominated Barnes for the honor flight. I'm really excited about it, and I think it's quite an honor, Barnes said. I never dreamed that I'd be on it. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, May 30th, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon.